Welcome to The Roundup, where we tackle big health topics from the outback to the tropics. I'm your host, Alyssa Hatherley, a local GP and head of James Cook University's Clinical School in Mackay. In each episode, you'll hear from experienced clinicians sharing expert insights on key regional health issues, best practice approaches, and practical strategies to improve patient care in regional and rural settings. Before we begin, I'd like to respectfully acknowledge the Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, their contributions to healthcare, and the traditional owners of the lands in which we practice and provide education. In today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Ritu Rana, an obstetrician, gynecologist, and fertility specialist in the Mackay region. Welcome, Ritu.
Hi, Alyssa. Good evening. Very nice to speak to you this evening. I'm quite excited.
Oh, we're always excited to talk about menopause. Now, I know this is a particular area of interest for yourself. You've been here in Mackay for 8 years now. Your training had been in the UK. I know you spend a lot of time talking to women affected by menopause, both to the patients and in the community as well. How many women are really suffering with menopause symptoms in our community on a day-to-day basis, Ritu?
I would like to say a huge percentage, Alyssa. I don't believe there is a definite number as to what percentage of women going through menopause have symptoms, because there is a big overlap in menopausal and some non-menopausal symptoms that can happen to women at that age. But that is something that we should all consider, and our patients should consider as well. I think if they are around the menopause age of 50 to 60 and having symptoms, which we will talk about very soon.
Yes, you're right. So menopause is that last period, isn't it, Ritu, which on average is about 51 years old, but women can be experiencing symptoms for many years prior to that, can't they?
That's right. Any time after early to mid 40s to up until 60, 65 years of age, we have to also bear in mind that there's a huge spectrum of age when menopause might happen. Anything from 45 years of age to up to 58, 59 can be very much normal, depending on the ethnicity as well sometimes.
And what are the symptoms that women often complain about when you see them in your clinic, Ritu?
It becomes a little biased when they come to a gynecology clinic. Most women would present first to see their general practitioners with similar symptoms. The type of people we see in the specialist gynae practice are the ones that cannot overcome their symptoms by simple measures. So what I see very often is hot flushes, night sweats, vaginal dryness, loss of interest in sex, reduced libido, sometimes pelvic pain and pressure, even sometimes bleeding or light bleeding or spotting from vagina from symptoms of menopause due to excessive thinning. I'm very sure, Alyssa, you see a bigger variety of symptoms in your practice.
Yes, you're right. Women can come in with all kinds of concerns with brain fog or insomnia or just generally dry, itchy skin that they've never experienced before. And often women just feel like they're completely dissociated from their usual selves and really quite at a loss as to how to make themselves feel better, aren't they?
That's right. Yeah. Alyssa, do you often see women with breast symptoms at the time of menopause?
I do often, and it seems a bit like women experience concerns like when they first get their period, when they're 12, 13, 14, their periods become heavier and crampier, they get dreadful breast tenderness, or they might feel that their breasts are getting bigger even maybe just that week or so before their period. And their mood might be particularly bad just before their period. Things that they remember from all those years ago seem to be bothering them again. And as long as their breast tenderness is symmetrical, so it's both breasts, and it's quite regularly happening with that period and settles down in between the periods, then we don't need to do any further investigations as long as their mammogram is up to date.
Yeah. And don't you think joint pain, joint discomfort, aching joints, I think that's another big symptom that women often come to us with, which again is very overlapping. Could be a sign of arthritis, but equally it could be something as simple as menopause.
Yes, I think you're right. And that misunderstanding is so common, isn't it? Women think they're supposed to have hot flushes and night sweats as a sign of menopause, but it could be a variety of other things. But those joint aches and pains are not very much fun, that's for sure.
Yeah. And I suppose when they present to you, you would start with some basic investigations, which should also probably include ruling out things like arthritis, other joint issues, but also have in the back of your mind that this could be menopause.
Yeah, you're right. So how do we best rule out other causes for the hot flushes, which are one of those pathognomonic symptoms? I tend just to make sure it's not their thyroid, and that their kidney and liver function is normal. I don't go looking for too many concerning features, I must admit. What is your standard workup for patients in whom you're thinking it might be menopause that's contributing to their symptoms?
When I feel that a patient has her symptoms that are related to menopause, we always start anything with a very detailed history. We would take a history of when their last period was. Often women are able to tell when the last period might have been. It may vary by a month or two, but usually they have a track. At other times, some women may not have periods for different reasons. Could be because they have a marina coil in the uterus. It could be because they've had a procedure that may have stopped their periods, like endometrial ablation or even hysterectomy. When we are not sure about the status of menopause, a simple blood test which checks their FSH and LH levels in their blood can sort of guide us if they are in the menopause range or not in the menopause range. I always examine women as well. Often my patients would present with vaginal or urinary symptoms. So vaginal symptoms would be something like excessive dryness, discomfort with intercourse, or pelvic heaviness. And urinary symptoms could be recurrent urine infection or a sensation of infection, or symptoms like bladder urgency, or even incontinence of urine on coughing, sneezing, or urgency of urine, where when they need to go, they need to rush to the toilet. So an examination gives a fair idea about how the vaginal tissues look. Do they look thinned out, atrophic, which gives us an idea. When I feel that their symptoms are related to menopause, usually I check that they don't have any contraindications, no reasons why they cannot have HRT, or where HRT could be more harmful to them than other women. And then usually I start with a moderate dose HRT and see them back after 6 weeks of use to see if they have responded and if their symptoms have improved. And if they have, then that's the diagnosis.
That's right. The treatment often makes it really clear, doesn't it? And I don't think women in the general public recognize how important that estrogen is to our whole body, to our cognitive function, to the health of our skin, including the skin inside the vagina and around the bladder, to how we feel generally in terms of our energy and those aches and pains that you mentioned. And it's that change in the estrogen level that really creates so many symptoms, isn't it? And we're needing to help women's bodies adjust to that new low estrogen environment.
That's right. I've actually had a couple of patients, Celissa, where they presented with brain fog, forgetfulness. Mm. That's all. And they said, we cannot come off HRT because it makes me a completely different person. I start forgetting things. I don't know where I kept something. As soon as we go back on it, our brain starts functioning again. I thought that was interesting.
So you mentioned a couple of tests that you might do, but mainly your diagnosis is based on your history with these particular women. You also mentioned that using estrogen is not advised in some women. Can you talk a little bit more about those women?
Yeah, so women who are at high risk from use of estrogen are someone who may have had certain type of cancers that are estrogen sensitive, particularly breast cancer. The other estrogen sensitive cancers are cancer of the uterus, certain types of ovarian cancer. And if they have a history of any of these, we try to manage their symptoms with other non-hormonal methods. There are certain rare situations where we still give them hormones for a short duration of time under supervision. The other high-risk population would be women who are excessively overweight, and due to that, they have a high risk of having clots in their legs or lungs, or if they have a personal history of clots in legs or lungs, estrogen can slightly increase that risk. So those are the situations where we are extra, extra careful before prescribing hormones.
So for those women who've had an estrogen positive breast cancer, for example, we wouldn't usually offer them hormone replacement therapy. But for women in whom there are no other treatment options, when we've counseled them about the potential risks and maybe talked about it with their oncologist as well, very occasionally we might offer medication to those women to alleviate their symptoms. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Most of those symptoms are related to vaginal dryness and slight bleeding on wiping, where a short course of vaginal estrogen replacement alleviates those symptoms, gets the vaginal health back. Usually I would use it for 6 weeks and then stop and see how they go. If required, we'd do it again in a few months' time.
Oh, well, that's really reassuring to hear, because Ritu, it was about 20 years ago, wasn't it, when there was a study released that said women who were taking hormone replacement therapy were at much increased risk of breast cancers. But when we look back at those studies, we realized that many of those women were quite elderly, they were overweight, they were smokers, and they were American too. They weren't even our Australian population. And we recognized that that risk is really not the same as for the women in whom we are actually on a day-to-day basis giving menopausal hormone treatment, is that our women are younger, generally fitter and healthier, smoking is much less common, and those risks associated with menopausal hormone therapy are not nearly as great as that study from 20 years ago suggested.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Alyssa. I'm really happy that you brought this research up. After this research was published nearly 20 years ago now, there was a big drive on women and doctors coming, you know, bringing their patients off HRT and for not giving patients HRT due to the risk of breast cancer. But since then, we have robust evidence to suggest that the actual risk of breast cancer is much, much lower than what we had thought. So generally quoting, we say that if 1,000 women are on HRT for 5 years, then their risk, then there will be one extra case of breast cancer, which is related to HRT.
And breast cancer is so incredibly common. One extra case is an incredibly small number considering the large number of women who we're treating, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I believe every, what, sixth woman these days has breast cancer or will have breast cancer at some point in their life.
That's right. That's our lifetime risk in Queensland. It's incredible.
So, Alyssa, what other advice do you give women who want to be or who do not want to be on hormone replacement with regards to reducing the risk of breast cancer?
So we know that for the vast majority of women, breast cancer just happens out of the blue. Women often say to me, I have no family history of breast cancer, yeah. But it's only a very small number of women who have that strong family history, that genetic link for their breast cancers. For most of us, it's just the fact that we're alive and have breast tissue, which of course is not just women, is it? It's men as well have breast tissue and are at risk of breast cancers, which they may not be aware of. The lifestyle factors that we know can increase a woman's risk of developing breast cancer is drinking alcohol. And really, that's the only risk factor that we have. Of course, your chance of any cancer increases if you drink alcohol, and it's not a lot. It's only one or two standard drinks of alcohol a day can increase your risk of cancer, breast and otherwise. And of course, all cancers increase in people who smoke. So looking after ourselves generally is incredibly important in reducing our risk of cancer. The other big risk factor that we have is that we're all living longer. We are enjoying a much longer lifespan than our grandparents, for example. And as we get older, our body's natural ability to fight off cancers deteriorates. And so just being alive increases our risk of cancer, unfortunately. So I try and encourage people to exercise, eat their fruit and vegetables, minimum alcohol, and to, of course, not smoke or any of those other concerning things. Is there anything else that we should be thinking about, do you think, Ritu?
Adequate weight.
Ah, yes, being overweight, that increased estrogen that you've already mentioned, you're right, that is an extra concern for women.
Yeah, for all types of cancers, which includes breast. Cancer of uterus is very common in women who have that extra weight because the little fat under the skin that changes our body's steroid hormones into estrogen in that layer of fat, which then thickens the lining of the uterus and can eventually cause cancer of the uterus. I certainly see more cancer of uterus in women who are on the bigger side of weight than the slimmer women.
Yes, gosh, that is an awful cancer. Now, Ritu, we've talked a bit about having hormone replacement therapy for our general body symptoms, like the aches and pains, the hot flushes, and our bladder symptoms. We've talked about estrogen into the vagina for those vaginal symptoms. Now, women who are taking hormone replacement therapy for their whole body symptoms might be offered a range of options by their doctor, mightn't they? They might be offered a tablet or a patch or an estrogen gel that they can rub into their skin, and maybe they would have a progesterone tablet or progesterone pessary into the vagina, or even a progesterone intrauterine contraceptive device. We've got a range of different options, don't we?
That's right, Alyssa. There's a huge range. The bottom line is that our bodies in the pre-menopause age, where women still ovulate, still produce eggs from their ovaries, we have two types of hormones in our body. One of them is estrogen, and estrogen is the hormone that is responsible for keeping us young, keeping our blood vessels nice and soft, reducing the risk of heart diseases, reducing the risk of blood pressure issues, and it gives keeps our skin youthful. And progesterone hormone, which is the second type of hormone that comes in our body after ovulation happens. Progesterone is a hormone of pregnancy, and it changes the lining of the uterus and makes it receptive to embryo to allow the baby to grow. The other benefit of progesterone hormone in our body when we are not pregnant is keeping the lining of the uterus under control, keeping it thin. So any woman who has a uterus needs to be on these two types of hormones, because taking only estrogen can increase the chance of thickening of the lining of uterus, which can lead to hyperplasia, so abnormal thickening and cancer. So it's important that everyone is on these two hormones if they have a uterus, or the other situation is where they have a history, strong history of endometriosis in the past. Women who don't have a uterus can be on estrogen-only hormone replacement.
These estrogen options, why would we use them through the skin as a patch or a gel rather than as a tablet, which you can also get?
Yeah. So when we take any hormone or any tablet by our mouth, it goes through our stomach, it gets absorbed through the stomach and the bowels, it goes to the liver where it gets processed and then finally used up by the rest of our body. When we use a medication through the skin in the form of a patch or a gel, it goes from our skin directly into our bloodstream. So it doesn't go past that metabolism, a longer metabolism through our liver. And any side effect that comes from these medications taken by mouth is reduced if we take it topical in the form of a gel, cream, or patch. These medications are particularly, the topical, the skin medication, are particularly useful for women who are at a high risk from taking oral tablets. For example, women who have a liver condition where their liver may not process the estrogen well, or they may have little tumors, adenomas in the uterus. We always prefer a topical for them. Mm-hmm. Women who have a history of clots in legs or lungs, if they need HRT, the safest route is through their skin. It is the safer route and quick absorption as well. But some women don't absorb it so well through their skin for various different reasons. Sometimes it can be irritating on their skin. Mm-hmm. In our tropical, lovely Queensland weather, sometimes the patches, they fall off because of sweating, excessive sweating. And in those situations, oral tablets are the best option for those women. And in most situations, they are safe as well.
It's a good reminder, isn't it, Ritu, that if you try something for hormone replacement therapy and it doesn't work for you, just go back to your doctor and have a talk about the other options available. Now, Ritu, What options do we have to help manage symptoms in women for whom hormone replacement therapy is not a good idea, or treatments that we can add to their hormone replacement therapy if that's not quite treating their symptoms adequately?
Yeah, so we always start in most treatments, we start with lifestyle modifications and adequate diet. Some diets have higher estrogen, like phytoestrogens in them, diets that are rich in soy, which can give them small amount of estrogen, but may be helpful for them. Not eating very high sugar and high fatty food may help with reducing these symptoms to some extent, because the body is not using up very high amounts of energy in processing that food in the body. I think exercise has a huge role as well in reducing the frequency of hot flushes. And is the overall well-being of a female, particularly in her 50s, improves their muscle strength, their bone strength, allows better absorption of calcium into their bones. Stress, sometimes cognitive behavior therapy, CBT, helps avoiding the trigger factors like excessive use of alcohol, caffeine that triggers hot flushes, trying to reduce those. These are some of the basic measures we start with. There are certain herbal supplements available as well. And some of these are things like black cohosh, evening primrose oil, St. John wort. There is some evidence to say that some women would benefit from these. So I feel there's no harm in trying them and see if that helps them to any degree. St. John wort, however, needs to be always notified because it can have some interaction with other medications. So if you're on St. John wort, make sure you always tell your doctor before you get any medication prescribed.
And St. John's wort, when we take it in too high a dose, can actually cause flushes too, can't it?
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's true too.
So we try with the lifestyle modifications, and then for women for whom menopausal hormone therapy might be helpful, we'll give that a go. We have a range of other non-hormonal things that might help with the flushes and night sweats too, don't we, Ritu?
Absolutely, yep. And a lot of times general practitioners do try those, and women, I've seen women who absolutely benefit so well with medications like SSRI or SNRI. Lisa, I'll let you talk a little bit more about this because I think you use it more often than we do.
You're right. We do use them quite often. So these are medications that are traditionally used to improve mood. So really good for depression and anxiety in women. But we did also recognize that they can reduce the number and intensity of hot flushes for some women. So for women who've had breast cancer, for example, and are on hormone blocking therapy, they might get dreadful hot flushes because of that medication-induced menopause. And using these SSRI or SNRI medications, as you mentioned, can really improve those flushes. And if they get a bit of a boost in their mood too, no one's going to say no to that, are they, Ritu? Everyone will appreciate that.
That's right. Yeah. Equally, there are some other medications that modify your nervous system, like gabapentin, pregabalin, clonidine. So there are a few alternatives that we have that can be tried. Not the same medication works for everyone. So a lot of times it's a matter of trying and testing what works for each patient.
And it might be a case of adding one and then another one and another one too. I do have a couple of ladies who need three or four different medications to help manage their symptoms adequately.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. Elsa, what do you advise them for vaginal dryness, especially discomfort with intercourse, dryness, feeling of burning in vagina? If women come to you with those symptoms, how do you deal with that?
So for women in whom it's not contraindicated, of course, that vaginal estrogen is incredibly helpful. Yeah. Women may not know that they actually need to use it quite frequently initially to build up the dose of estrogen in their system. So okay. Usually I would ask women to use it every night for 2 weeks and then maybe twice a week. Twice a week may not be enough. They might need it every second night, for example. Yeah. But if that's helpful, that's fabulous. For women who need to avoid that estrogen therapy, then they might find some benefit in using a simple lubricant, vaginal lubricant, maybe one that's silicone-based rather than water-based. The other things that we do have available are vaginal moisturizers. One is Replenz, and we have a new vaginal, not a lubricant, is it? Presterone goes into the vagina, but it's not hormonal, but makes a big difference to that vaginal lubrication and comfort for women who need to avoid a vaginal estrogen.
I've had really good results from Replenz as well. So it works for 3 days, and you can insert it in your own time after a shower. And if you leave it in there, it works for 3 days, keeps the vagina moisturized. Equally, the other silicone-based moisturizers work really well.
And they're not on prescription too, so that makes them just that little bit more accessible for our ladies.
Exactly, yeah. For excessive discomfort, sometimes a short course or occasional use of vaginal lignocaine gel may also be helpful. So vaginal lignocaine gel is available in 2% and 4% gel form. And it for extreme vaginal discomfort, particularly at the time of either passing urine or having intercourse, this can be quite a helpful measure in reducing that discomfort, especially while you're waiting for the vaginal estrogen to kick in, to start working.
Oh, that's an excellent idea, Ritu. And isn't it fantastic when women notice a significant improvement in their bladder control as well as their vaginal symptoms? That often takes my patients by surprise.
I bet they thank you so much for that help.
You are right about that, I must admit. For women who have no relief from the other medications for their hot flushes, Ritu, we have that new fezolinetant, I think it's pronounced. That's the medication that works centrally to improve thermoregulation centers in the brain. I've only prescribed it once, but it has made a big difference to that patient.
Oh, that's so good to hear. I'm glad that we have more and more medications coming in, and we have a variety of things that can be tried to see what works for whom.
Now, Ritu, sometimes women will actually have a significant itch around the vulva that presents around the time of the menopause, don't they? Sometimes that can be lichen sclerosis presenting.
That's right. So lichen sclerosis is more common than what we think. It presents as sometimes intense vaginal vulval itch. Vulval is the area outside the vagina, which has the outer lips and the inner lips. Women come with symptoms saying that I want to rip off myself down below because that's how itchy it is. At other times, they can be just sore down below. They say that it hurts and stings when they pass urine. These symptoms can sometimes be just from menopause, but at other times it may be a lichen sclerosis that we don't know about. So it's really important if women are facing those symptoms that they go and see their doctor and have a thorough examination to see if they could be having these changes, which are lichen sclerosis or lichen simplex, that often happen at this time in life or often present at this time in life, and they can have some significant impact on someone's quality of life.
I just take a little punch biopsy using a little bit of lignocaine just to confirm the diagnosis, and then it's really easy to treat, isn't it, Ritu?
That's right, a topical steroid. So applying steroid ointment outside in the on the outer and inner lips often would treat this condition. It's simple to treat. The treatment has to be aggressive at the start and slowly taper it down, but it is treatable. So please take help if you face symptoms like this.
It is really easy to treat, isn't it? And the symptomatic improvement is just massive. Now, goodness me, Ritu, we've talked about a lot of things. So we've talked about the menopause being the last period. We've talked about the changes that can be in any part of our bodies in the lead up to that last period and the medications that we can use to alleviate some of those symptoms. We've talked about using estrogen and progesterone when you have the uterus, and we can use that as a tablet, a cream, a patch, a gel, or an intrauterine device. We've talked a lot about non-hormonal medications that can also help to alleviate some of those symptoms, and particularly about vaginal estrogen and non-estrogenic treatments to help with those vaginal and bladder symptoms. Now, Ritu, bladders, they can be such a big problem, can't they, for women? And often women say to me, oh, it's just a little bit of light bladder leakage. That's quite normal. I don't think it is. Do you have a particular viewpoint?
Bladder leakage is not normal, but it's surprising how common it is.
Mm.
And women often think it's part of being a woman and they put up with it for a very, very long time until it starts affecting their day-to-day quality of life. There are two types of bladder leaks that can happen to women. We call it stress incontinence and urge incontinence. So stress incontinence is where leaking of urine happens in small or large amounts when women cough, sneeze, run, laugh, or jump or play. So anything that increases the abdominal pressure gets them to leak urine. The other type of leaking is the urge urinary incontinence. This means that when they need to pass urine, when their bladder feels full, they cannot hold the bladder any longer. They have to rush to the toilet. And very often they would leak on the way to the toilet.
Mm.
So type of leaking and different type of management. Once again, if you have bladder leak problems, please go and see your GP. Both of them can be quite simple to manage, but equally they can be quite difficult to manage depending on the severity of the symptoms and the reason for the symptoms.
If it's just something simple like an undiagnosed urinary tract infection, or if it's those thin atrophic tissues at the time of menopause, then treating each of those conditions appropriately can make an enormous difference to your symptoms, can't it?
That's exactly right. But if it's because your tissues have become very weak from childbirth and lack of estrogen in the tissues and advancing age, then it can be a bit more tricky to manage because sometimes it would need intense physiotherapy. But if that doesn't work, it may sometimes need a surgical repair.
So if women are experiencing bladder symptoms, always go and see your GP first, and then they might be able to refer you on to the right kind of practitioner to help you further.
And that's exactly right. Yeah.
Now, Dr. Ritu Rana in the Mackay region, is there anything else about menopause that we haven't talked about today that we should talk about for our listeners?
Alyssa, I don't think we can finish this talk without talking about Roche and the compounded hormone replacement treatment, because we find a lot of women are on this medication. And you and I have both talked about this before, and we feel that this is something new, not commonly used by most of us. But equally, we have to remember that a lot of women are on it. What is your take on this?
I'm always a little bit nervous that women are being given one part of the troche, like the estrogen, for example, without adequately also having progesterone as part of their medication. I have seen lots of women who've had a really abnormally thickened endometrium because of too much estrogen. Have you seen that a few times too?
Yes. So I've looked into some of the guidelines about this. So far, we don't know a lot about compounded medications as hormone replacement. There is no guidelines, no evidence-based, strong evidence-based behind it. And their regulation on the compounded hormone replacement is not as robust as we do for the for our conventional hormone replacement. So when problems happen with this medication, we don't have a strong leg to stand on. I cannot say that it doesn't work because it does, but I don't know how well we can monitor these medications.
I suppose the other thing to think about too is that women will have a blood test or a salivary test to check what their hormone levels are today, and they're prescribed a troche to change their body's hormone level back to what it should have been like during the fertile years. When we're at menopause, we shouldn't be having our hormone levels like they were in the fertile years, because that time has passed. And of course, our hormone levels in our blood or our saliva today are going to be very different to what they are next week or even tomorrow, because they go up and down. So it's really fraught with some difficulty, I think, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. You're spot on this. Monitoring of hormone replacement treatment can absolutely not be relied upon based on saliva test or even a blood test. What will help us monitor is how women feel with their symptoms on any particular dose of hormone replacement. If their symptoms get better on a very small dose of HRT, then that's the right dose for them. If that doesn't work so well for them, we go up the dose. And if they respond, then that's the right dose for them. So it's dose modification is based on symptoms rather than a blood or a saliva test.
Yeah, that's so sensible. So we should probably also talk about stopping the HRT then, shouldn't we? So for those women who find that their symptoms have improved, we probably want to stop their hormone replacement sometime between now and 5 years' time, because we know after 5 years, some of those risks start to increase again, don't they, Ritu?
That's right. The chance of breast cancer goes up ever so slightly higher than what it is within the first 5 years of use.
I tend to ask women to try and stop their HRT or reduce the dose of their HRT during the cooler months. And if their symptoms recur, then I say, that's all right, we'll just keep going for another 12 months and try again next year. Do you think that's a reasonable way to manage those patients?
Oh, that's so sensible to try and reduce their doses in the cooler months.
I think it would be an unfair or an unkind thing to try and ask women to do in North Queensland over summer, that's for sure.
That's right. Now, you're absolutely right. Go down the dose, taper it down slowly, see how they feel on a smaller dose, and then eventually see how they feel after stopping it. And sometimes it is a question of remaining on a smaller dose for a period of time, 6 months, 12 months, and then trying to stop it. And sometimes some women absolutely cannot stop it. Their symptoms come back as soon as they stop. Would you be happy to continue those women for a longer time on HRT, Alyssa?
I would be reluctant, but of course, keeping those women symptom-free and, you know, able to live their best lives is the most important thing. As long as we have that conversation about those potential risks of taking HRT for longer, then I'm happy to let women stay on it. At the end of the day, there's no value in stopping a medication that's helping someone just to tick a box. We need to make sure our patients are as comfortable and able to live their best lives as we possibly can.
Absolutely. It's about quality of life and balancing it well with the risk as well. So as long as someone's very physically active in a good weight range, they get their regular mammograms, and they come and report any unusual symptoms, I think it is quite reasonable to continue it for longer when needed.
And in terms of those unusual symptoms, Ritu, is it mainly vaginal bleeding that you're looking out for?
That's one of the most important ones, I suppose. Yes. So postmenopausal bleeding or bleeding after menopause is not normal. Any woman who has bleeding after menopause needs to go and see their doctor, report the bleeding to them. And then it is up to the doctor to decide whether it needs any further investigation or not. The same condition applies to women who are on hormone replacement. So don't assume that the bleeding has happened just because you're on these hormones or you forgot to take a hormone. If there is any vaginal bleeding after menopause, please go and see your doctor. You may need no further test, or sometimes you may need an ultrasound scan. And sometimes it might mean a visit to a specialist.
That's an incredibly important message to finish on, Ritu. Dr. Ritu Rana, specialist obstetrician, gynecologist, and fertility specialist in the Mackay region. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me, Alyssa. That was very nice, informative discussion. And I hope that helped some of our women in the town and the region.
I have no doubt it has. Ritu, thank you.
Thank you.
For more information about the Roundup or to share your feedback and ideas for future episodes, visit nqrth.edu.au/roundup-podcast or contact us at nqrth.mackay@jcu.edu.au. We also want to advise that the views and opinions presented in this podcast are those of the speaker only and do not represent the views and opinions of James Cook University, Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs, or Queensland Health. The content supplied in this podcast is not intended as medical advice and is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs is an initiative of the Australian Government's Integrated Rural Training Pipeline, and is facilitated by James Cook University in partnership with public and private hospitals, Queensland Aboriginal and Islander Health Council, health services, Aboriginal community controlled health organisations, and general practice clinics.